netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hello, and welcome to the FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. Our guest this week is Paul Dvorak, a longtime friend of FX Guide, and this year marks the 25th anniversary of his Fiat Lux film. The guys definitely talk about that as part of the podcast. They also cover a lot of interesting things, not just about that video, but other things that Paul has worked on in the past, and I think you'll really enjoy it. Before we cross that conversation, I just want to mention that for those of you who are listening to the audio version of this podcast, we do have a video version of this on our YouTube channel. So go ahead over there and check it out. It's got a lot of great additional B-roll to help tell all the story of what the guys are talking about. So let's go ahead and cross the conversation now, Mike and Paul.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Mike, it's always a pleasure. Great to be here.
In like October 22, we were celebrating that little movie that you made up at Berkeley, and it was 25 years, which was for your PhD. But we're now here with you because we want to celebrate like a couple of milestones, which all seem to line up, which we're going to work our way through, starting with the 25 years of Fiat Lux. But as we were just about to record this, you were commenting that there's a bunch of 25-year anniversaries around this point in time, right? Because this is a very productive time for your career and for the industry in terms of SIDGRAPH presentations and whatnot.
Yeah, the late 90s were good because I finished the PhD thesis on Facade at the end of 96. And instead of going to join a startup like so many of my friends were in the dot-com boom of the era, I decided to stay at Berkeley as a postdoc for another 3.5 years. And that, you know, I mean, it wasn't financially a great decision, but in terms of getting some things done and getting to explore some ideas that I was excited about, it was really wonderful because I was, you know, kind of at the height of being able to program computers. I was in this rich environment of motivated, excited, smart Berkeley students that were looking for cool things to do while they were undergrads and grad students. And it was an exciting time in the field of computer graphics because it was the huge wave of image-based modeling and rendering, and there's so many cool problems to attack.
So I was trying desperately to work out when I first bumped into you, or at least worked out, you know, who you were. And the best that I could piece it out is I was ignorant in 97. In 98, I'm pretty sure I saw Rendering with Natural Light, which was 98, right? But I didn't work out who it was you. I just saw it and was like, that's interesting. And then it was Fiat Lux in 99, where I was like, what's going on here? Like that was the kind of moment I think that I first, and it was around that time. When did HDR Shop and that stuff come out? It was after that that I remember interviewing you for the first time.
Yeah. Well, HDR Shop actually came out of the Fiat Lux animation that we did in 99. Because we had to push the tools for dealing with high dynamic range imagery into, you know, doing our production that we were making. And like there weren't production tools. Photoshop didn't support high dynamic range images. We needed to edit HDR images because, you know, we had backgrounds shot in St. Peter's Basilica that had like, you know, extraneous things in it or people milling about. There's this group of three nuns that were by the altar, which aren't supposed to be in the film, and they're lovely, but you know, we have to Photoshop them out somehow, but Photoshop doesn't support HDR. So that's where the idea of HDR Shop came. And
it's a bit hard to tell some nuns, nuns to move on, isn't it? It's like, you can't really
no,
say.
No, because they're supposed to be there and we're not really supposed to be there. We were lucky to get the permission we did to shoot that. So I think HDR Shop, the first EXE I can find of it that I have on a hard drive is from the year 2000. And then when we got to USC ICT in 2000, I made it a full-on project to develop and support that and make it available to the community.
Yeah, well, it's definitely Fiat Lux that it was the first time I remember people coming up to me and saying, have you seen this? You know, I mean, like that was like of your work. They were like, what, you know, and we were all like, what is this? And so we've discussed it a little bit technically in the past, and we have posted some marvelous stuff on FX Guide in the past, but I don't think I've ever asked you this question. Where did the actual idea of the kind of dominoes and metal balls and stuff come from? Like just from an artistic point of view for a second, before we look at anything technical, like you had this concept of going there. You could have done anything, could have just been an architectural visualization type thing, but you did this whacked out domino, you know, kind of, I don't know. I mean, it was brilliant, right? But it was quite artistic as much as it was technical.
Thank you very much. I mean, that was the, like, technically the idea was to try to combine the image-based lighting technology of rendering with natural light with the photogrammetry technology of the Campanile movie and see if they go together and we can make something that's more than the sum of its parts, which was the idea. But I was also, you know, at the time trying to do something that would stand on its own artistically. Like the Campanile movie had gotten invited to a number of film festivals, like South by Southwest, actually way back when it was new. Wow. In the 90s, like invited it to be presented there. And it kind of felt like these things were, you know, a lot of people, they could watch it. And as much as it was, you know, an effort to show some new technology, it was also an effort to tell something of a story or a visual experience. And
that movie had lots of interesting visual elements. I'm going to say tricks, but that's doing a disservice. But, you know, I mean, like the pullouts that suddenly realized that you were holding the model and, you know, like the transitions were more than just technical demonstrations. You were having fun with it visually.
Yeah, that was a thought. I mean, I had done the SIGGRAPH paper in 96 and we showed the requisite, you know, animation of like a building spinning around like my high school, or we had one model of the Campanile. But, you know, in the Campanile movie, I thought it would be really exciting to not just reconstruct a building, but also its environment so that you could kind of feel it was all part of one realistic scene from corner to corner of the image and then fly around it. And then how do we, you know, how do we kick it up a notch, as it were? How do we kick the lamp on this one? And that was fun. I mean, I certainly liked, you know, M.C. Escher kinds of things growing up as a lot of computer scientists did, and playing with that visually. I think actually so much of the research of the Campanile movie was about the interplay between like a real building and then the CGI model of it that looks as realistic as possible to the real building. And then by adding in this third element of actually paying to get a model miniature made of the Berkeley Tower that could unite these other two, it gave us a way to transition between these three elements every which way. And that's what we did in the film.
But if that film had a almost tongue-in-cheek kind of appeal of being like, not cheeky, but just, you know, whimsical, Fiat Lux has this very somber, very, you know, different vibe to it. So it really stepped it up there in terms of like artistic intent. I mean, the music is one of the things that makes it. But also artistically, the halation and the light play is sort of very ethereal.
Yeah. So thanks. So, I mean, the artistic drive from it, as I was, and by the way, there's no need for anyone to get this while they're watching it. You know, when you're creating a film, you can bring a lot of, you know, personal elements into the film, which is your way of getting it out of you and something onto the screen. And if it means something to somebody else, that's great. You just want to have something that had some meaning at some point. And, you know, for me, after, you know, when my mom was married to her second husband, and I was a teenager, you know, and things were kind of a little rough around then, he would go to church, and, you know, I wasn't particularly religious, and I was, you know, studying calculus in high school. And, you know, I was aware of the kind of the conflict between, you know, science and the church around the time of Galileo. Galileo kind of embodies that. And I would end up, you know, kind of being dragged to church on a Sunday morning when I'd rather be sleeping in or, you know, playing in the yard or programming something on my Commodore 64. And I would bring my calculus homework with me. I would bring this thick book. Everyone else was reading a different book, but I was reading this calculus book and learning about, you know, taking the integral under a parabola or something like that. And I would just, you know, sit and do my calculus homework while everyone else, you know, did the rest of the ceremony. And after about six times, I think people got it. I didn't have to go anymore. And I'm not even sure where I was at the time I was making Fiat Lux, but I think a lot of my feeling in terms of like the conflict between science and religion that the film is about kind of came from some of those moments.
Was it high church? Was it like?
I think it was an Episcopal church, and there were pews, and I think it was I don't know too much about it. It was technically Protestant, but it was like the kind of Protestant that's as close as you can get to Catholicism, at least in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois. And, you know, at the same time, I had you know, been, you know, to some, a couple trips to Europe as a kid, and been absolutely astounded by, you know, the beauty and the symmetry and the engineering of cathedrals, and seeing how, you know, this technological marvel, you know, really could inspire awe. And that was one of the reasons that you build a cathedral, is because you want to inspire awe in the people who come visit that. So I think I was also, you know, since I'd done, you know, architecture, the Campanile movie was kind of about architecture, exterior architecture, that was grand, which is a tower, and interior architecture, which is grand, could be a cathedral, or in the case of St. Peter's, a basilica.
So, as I said, you got this great ethereal look, and you had these amazing kind of halation and light because of the technology. Let me start by asking, technically, what was it actually rendered in?
It was rendered in Radiance. This is the ray tracing-based lighting simulation system developed by Lawrence Berkeley Laboratories and written by Greg Ward, who's an awesome guy. And rendering of natural light was also rendered with Radiance. And, you know, I think at some point, since I was at Berkeley, we'd have like a weekly group meeting where someone would present a paper, you know, for the research group. And Greg was, you know, interested enough of stuff that was going on. And so we'd end up at some of the same meetings. I'd chat with him, and I knew he was into lighting simulation. I had to study how ray tracing and radiosity global illumination works in order to just pass my qualifying exam when I was doing my PhD. And we would chat occasionally. And at one point I proposed this idea to him of storing high dynamic range images. You know, I'd done a paper or was working on a paper for SIGGRAPH 97, probably when I was talking to him, of this idea that, you know, instead of using 32-bit precision floating point for red and green and blue, which would take 12 bytes per pixel, I thought, well, maybe since, you know, if it's bright, probably all the channels are bright, or, you know, you could just have one exponent and you probably don't need as much precision. So maybe we'll just have, like, you know, one byte for exponent, and then one byte for precision for that. And he realized this is extremely close to the high dynamic range image format he'd already implemented inside his renderer to render out HDR images straight out of the renderer, which is called Radiance format. Unfortunately, he had titled it .pic, because to him, these were just a way to put out a picture. And our computers would keep thinking they were like the .pict format and loading them wrong. So I didn't have any influence on that format other than suggesting, hey, maybe you should just call it .hdr, because these are high dynamic range images and we don't have any other convenient way other than like floating point TIFF at the time, which was huge. But then, yeah, we could start call these Radiance images .hdrs for that.
So how long were these frames in render? Like, they must have taken forever back then.
I was lucky, and I think we, even for rendering natural light, we started rendering to a little bit of a farm. I think Berkeley, because, you know, we also had you know, people doing high performance computing research, had some high performance computing clusters, and the rendered natural light probably got rendered on like 16 computers, and we wrote like a very basic scheduler to, you know, send jobs out, pick a computer that's not too busy, and then check to see that it finished, you know, before you send off another one to that. And for Fiat Lux, we found a way to render on three different clusters. One of them was called the Millennium Cluster, right? Because it was the turn of the millennium at the time. And they had this huge set of, I think, 400 megahertz Intel PC-based computers running Linux. Professor David Culler was the head of this group. He's a big person in this area. And it was wonderful to be able to use that, except for the fact that at the same time, there was this SETI at home project, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
Everybody was asked to just run this everywhere around the world. And the idea we'd have like somehow sort of cloud of just people processing that would max out and find aliens effectively.
Yes, exactly. And so, you know, David Culler's graduate students thought our project to render out Fiat Lux was pretty cool and put tons of instances of Radiance running, but they also thought it was pretty cool to do the SETI at home project. And that was our competition for computational resources. And when it came time to like get the version ready to submit to SIGGRAPH, like I had to send a polite email like, would it be okay not to look for aliens for like maybe the next 3 nights because we need to get our film rendered for that. And yeah. they're very gracious about that.
Yeah, very much a kind of a user-led initiative that didn't actually find many aliens that I'm aware of, but you don't even know, right? Okay, so
we got our stuff rendered. You asked about the halation filters as well. And one of the things that's great about having like a high dynamic range rendering pipeline is, you know, first of all, that you can get it to do like accurate lighting calculations, accurate reflections. If you look at the monoliths of Fiat Lux, which are kind of this black shiny material, the reflections actually show you an image of the scene that's, you know, five stops down from directly looking at the scene. So you need to have HDR. You're kind of, everything in that scene is also kind of designed to show you the fact that things are high dynamic range. You get high dynamic range motion blur when things flip around, which was extra computation to figure out how to do that. But you know, you get these renderings out in, you know, .hdr format that, you know, have pixel values that go 1 to 1,000,000 or 0.0001 to a million. And, you know, it would feel sad just to like, you know, clip them 0 to 1 and, you know, put them into your movie file. And, you know, cameras don't actually just record the 0 to 1. There's all these other optical effects that happen in lenses that kind of reveal the dynamic range of the scene as well. And a big one is kind of, you know, flare and bloom. The lens that I shot a lot of the St. Peter's Basilica material with was actually a lens that had, unfortunately, tons of flare and bloom in it because, you know, I only had 60 minutes to shoot all that material. And I had to use the widest lens I had, which was a kind of junk 14 millimeter Sigma lens that you could put onto your Canon mount. And it had the kind of like this weird reddish glare to it, some of which we had to edit out. But it kind of showed off the dynamic range. And I wanted to have like a controllable, beautiful out of focus or you know, glare filter that went on to show the blossoming and the light wrap around. There's like a pendulum. And at some point it goes in front of a window and the light just wraps around it. And that That's really beautiful. Helps that CGI element, you know, exist within the scene. And I'd done that before for rendering with natural light. And I think what I did is I did 5 different Gaussian blurs of the image, like 1 pixel, like 2 pixels, 5 pixels, 10 pixels, and 50 pixels or something like that. And I just played with a linear combination of these different blurred versions of them. Got the coefficients. And when it came time to do Fiat Lux, I thought, okay, I'm going to totally re-engineer this. I'm going to come up with like even better glare filters. And actually I was unable to. I could not come up with anything that I or anybody else liked better than exactly the glare filter we used with rendering with natural light. So that's what you see in Fiat Lux.
So that's the SIGGRAPH Theater in 99. And I imagine I wasn't there. It was Los Angeles, wasn't it? In 99? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I imagine you got a really good reaction on the day. But you immediately kind of, I mean, if you were coming back the next year, we'd have kind of expected you to go sort of more directly on that path. But unbeknownst to us when we were, who didn't know you and we're just sitting on the other side of the planet, next year was like Light Stage 1, wasn't it, in 2000?
Yeah. So the reaction at SIGGRAPH 99, it was nice to have it. And something that was, you know, the two things that happened, one of which is that the SIGGRAPH Electronic Theater chair, Brian Blau, put it at the opening of the SIGGRAPH Electronic Theater that year. And, you know, since I've since been an electronic theater chair, it's like you try to have like, you know, a progression to your show and think about how you're beginning and how you bring the mood up and down and try to end it. The best SIGGRAPH Electronic Theaters actually work themselves as more than just you know, a compilation of short films, but themselves have their own.
Yeah, they're tightly curated. Yeah,
and they're tightly curated, and you know, a lot of the pieces have to be edited down to work for the show too. But Brian said that he put it in the front, you know, because he sort of felt like it's like an opening prayer at the beginning of the show, and you know, the music that I ended up going with, you know, I actually tried to get period accurate music for that, so. Galileo and the church, you know, most of that history and the conflict, and being called in and forced to recant that, you know, it's a, that it's a heliocentric instead of a geocentric solar system, was in the, like, around 1630 or so. And so I actually went to the Berkeley Music Library and I listened to a lot of stuff from 1630, and pretty much none of it worked. It just, like, it was way too kind of just light and just, like, unimpactful. It was just kind of like friendly little chords and plucks on a mandolin or something like that.
You were after some sort of Gregorian chant or something? Was that what you were expecting?
So we ended up, yeah, which is about 200 or about 100 years later is when you'd get, like, the kind of chant that I actually ended up putting on there. So, I mean, St. Peter's was standing when that music was written, but it wasn't when the conflict with Galileo happened. But it
was still standing when the Sex Pistols were screaming. So that's a fairly
white. So you can pretty much
have anything you like.
Any kind of modern Western music or non-modern Western
anyway,
music.
I digress.
But yeah, I chose that. It worked. The other thing that happened in 99 that was some a sense of the response is that there was also this documentary called The Story of Computer Graphics, directed by Frank Foster. And in the weeks leading up to SIGGRAPH, I got requested, could I give them some footage from Fiat Lux to include in this documentary about basically the history of computer graphics to date? And that was exciting. They also asked, and by the way, we're making it in this very exciting new format called HD. It's got to be high definition. And Fiat Lux was actually originally rendered at, you know, widescreen standard def, where you do like 720 by 480 with a 1.2 to 1 aspect ratio. So it ends up being 16 by 9. And, you know, at the show, actually, I knew Fiat Lux was going to play in a 4x3 screen, and I submitted on Digibeta. And one of the decisions that I made was to actually do the glare filter after the letterboxing. So if you watch the 4:3 version of the film, and there's a bright light near the top, the glare goes right over.
And on the floor, by the way,
the
floor breaks the letterbox as well.
Yep.
Yep.
And I remember, like, when I saw, you know, Life of Pi 3D and the fish jump over out of the screen in 3D and they go into the letterboxing. I think they even, like, intentionally letterboxed that sequence just for a while so the fish can fly off the screen. I was reminded by that and enjoyed that especially. But for Story of Computer Graphics, it was straight 16 by 9, so you don't see that. But we did re-render about a minute and a half of Fiat Lux at native high definition for that, which I'm glad they got us to do.
So you've got the whole stuff happening. I'm just going to chronologically jump forward a little. You've got the whole lot of stuff happening with Lightstage, which is a story unto itself, and we've discussed it in the past. I'm not going to go deep into the Lightstage now, but suffice it to say, 2002, which is the year after we just discussed, that's Spider-Man 2, right? And then, and the whole visual effects community is, like, waking up to this technology. But 2004... yeah, we now have the 20th anniversary of the Parthenon, which isn't light stagey at all. It's like another.
No.
So how did you get, like, that's three sort of different directions, it seems. Or did you feel like the Parthenon was a sort of a callback to the Fiat Lux? I don't know. How did that happen?
So, well, the reason that the light stages got started, and was a little bit of this interruption of looking at architectural subjects, is that at some point I realized, you know, I'm making films here, and I probably won't be able to make films forever without eventually putting a person in the movie. And to do that, because I was making CGI films, that I would need to somehow have a way of either taking live action actors and putting them in the film, or creating digital actors that would be in the film. And in either case, the whole, you know, idea is to do photorealism. So it's realistic enough that one thing that you change to be beyond what reality allows, like, really, you know, kind of hits hard, and you can enjoy that because you establish realism with how everything looks. Like in the Campanelli movie, you couldn't have done that camera move back then. And everything should look totally photoreal, except boom, there's that camera move. And the transitions to the model and back. And then, you know, in Fiat Lux, you know, hopefully it really looks like St. Peter's Basilica. So if you see 24-foot tall monoliths falling over in it, you can think, wow, that would be really cool to see that. I am seeing that. That's kind of what it would look like. I think those huge metal spheres would have gone straight through the floor into the crypt with how much they would have weighed, but that's real enough to have fun. So anything that we did with people was going to have to be photo real. And the next idea was, since we'd shown with image-based lighting, that we could put CGI objects into a scene and get the right reflections and shadows and lighting and all of that, how would we, you know, put people into the scene, right? And so I thought, well, we have to do image-based lighting on people, so let's light people with HDRI maps. And that was the idea of surrounding actors with LEDs, which we did in 2002, but we couldn't really do that in 2000. And 2000 was a way of getting away with simulating that with one light, you know, rotating around, and then you do the simulation. But the Parthenon film, and that's, I realized, like, it's 20 years since we did the Parthenon film. That's what happened. Yep. And came out at a SIGGRAPH 2004, which is like the last electronic theater movie that I got to direct, was about trying to, you know, check maybe another couple boxes in, you know, sort of like the technological pipeline that we want to be able to use to create, you know, films that look real but are created digitally. And it was really about exploring how 3D scanning can allow us to create much more organic shapes. The facade system that I'd written for my PhD thesis, and we used to model, you know, 38 buildings for the Berkeley campus, and then the interior St. Peter's Basilica for Fiat Lux, leveraged a lot about architectural symmetry and regular forms and shapes. And to do the Parthenon, which is like architecturally, you know, just as significant as St. Peter's Basilica, it's unfortunately, it's a ruin. And, you know, we could model it with polyhedral primitives as much as we wanted. We weren't going to get anything that looked like modern Parthenon. And the other thing that I, you know, that kind of inspired me to use to do the Parthenon is I had a visit to a museum at the University of Illinois that happened to have, and that's my hometown, it happened to have plaster copies of about 167 feet of the Parthenon frieze, which is kind of a
The ones from the English Museum? They had plaster casts from the British Museum?
Plaster casts are the ones that are in the British Museum, yes.
Okay.
And that's where, you know, I went to see, and somebody had told me, hey, that'd be really interesting. If you're into architecture, you should check this out. I went there and they had a booklet, a pamphlet about these Parthenon sculptures. I guess for a while in Britain, they were called the Elgin Marbles because Lord Elgin had brought them back from Athens. And I read about the history of the Parthenon and how it had been built as a Greek temple and then was kind of like, upgraded by the Romans to be a Roman temple. And then at some point, was actually converted in the Middle Ages into a cathedral. And it was Our Lady of Athens Cathedral for a long time. And it had, they built an apse into it. There's still Christian crosses carved into it. In 1687, there was quite an event that happened, which is at that point, it had actually been turned into a mosque by the Ottomans.
Doing and the full range of religious experiences here.
It's like it's been kind of every religious kind of thing at this point. And the Venetians, the Ottomans weren't getting along. And I guess like the Ottomans attacked the Venetians somewhere. So the Venetians, when they're coming back from some trip, they decide, okay, we're gonna fire back on the Ottomans, and they attack their stronghold on the Acropolis. And unfortunately, one of the mortar shells went through a window of the Parthenon at the time. And that happened to be where the Ottomans were storing a lot of their gunpowder, and it just blew the thing apart. The reason it looks the way today that it does is because, you know, the entire center of the Parthenon just exploded dramatically in 1687 that one night, and it knocked out the sides of the columns. And that's pretty much the state that Lord Elgin saw it in when he visited in the very early 1800s. And, you know, the Ottomans were still nominally in control, and they would be for a few more decades at that point. But that's when he negotiated in some form to be able to take some of the sculptural decorations back to England, and it's a real question. He seems to have overstepped what he actually had negotiated in terms of how much he took back, and it probably didn't include sawing the sculptures remaining off of the structure that were still okay, and bringing a lot of those back to the British Museum. And that kind of takes it to the modern era, where it's a modern, you know, kind of a political controversy. Where should these sculptures be? Should they be in the British Museum? Should they be in the Acropolis Museum? And the Acropolis Museum would be happy to have them back, and they have nice little spots ready for them all to return to for that. So my thought was that, well, we could at least do it digitally. We could go and scan the sculptures with structured light scanning. We could scan the Acropolis with time of flight laser scanning. And, you know, kind of to denote the passage of time, we'll not only deal with like all these shapes we couldn't have modeled before, but let's not just relight the objects we're putting in. Let's relight the whole scene itself. Let's scan the Parthenon in a way that I can then like literally light it however I need for the film that I'm making. And that really upped the ante for what we needed to do with the Parthenon. We didn't relight St. Peter's Basilica. I got exactly the light that I got that day when I could get in and shoot the photos. But the Parthenon, I wanted to show an entire time of day sequence.
Well, you've got the time lapse at the beginning of the video, haven't you? Yeah. So,
yeah.
But I'm asking the same thing. This must have been like, it's a big thing. Like, I mean, I imagine that the British Museum, the sculptures that are there, and let's not get into the politics of whether they should or not, but they're at least eye height, right? Like you can imagine getting to the scanners, but the Parthenon is a huge bloody thing. I mean, how did you actually scan it at the accuracy you need? Because you're putting things up the top of it, and that's exactly where it would be hardest to scan.
Yeah. So we were lucky to kind of partner with QuantaPoint, which had one of the early, especially fast laser scanners that was out there. It could scan 100,000 points per second. But only like centimeter-ish resolution. We're happy to get some help from the University of Pisa, CNR Pisa, because they had implemented some of Stanford's volumetric mesh merging algorithms and made those available to put all of those scans together. But you know, getting to the level of resolution that we needed, you know, it was difficult in some ways. I was very lucky that I had two digital artists working for me at USC ICT, Brian Emerson and Mark Brownlow. And they could kind of, you know, fill in areas that we didn't scan too well, as well as they created the version of the Parthenon that shows it, you know, historically, like before the explosions and back as a Greek temple.
But hang on a sec. So you're reading this pamphlet. You say, this is really interesting. We could reconstruct it and do this. How long and how hard is it to go from that to getting permission to do all this stuff, permission to do it in England and in obviously in Europe, but also then build this tech team and sort of collective of like-minded researchers?
Well, it took a while. I think I read that pamphlet in 1996, actually, if I remember.
Okay.
Because by 1998, I actually had a trip I went on with some friends to Turkey. And I just kind of like took off on my own to fly, you know, from Turkey to Athens. And I had 4 days in Athens, you know, by myself just to familiarize myself with the Acropolis and check out the old Acropolis Museum that was there. I made a total of 5 trips to Athens in the course of making that film, the last of them being in very early 2004. And I actually haven't been back since. I'm looking for it. Sometime I got to get back to Greece at this point. But getting the permissions was tricky. That was actually the most nerve-wracking part about it, was how are we going to, you know, have them let us, you know, tromp all over, you know, the Acropolis to do the scanning that we need to. And like, also like convincing them that like, you know, I'm not a modern day Lord Elgin looking to, you know, capture everything out there and then use it for stuff that, you know, they'd be concerned about what's happening. I was concerned also about the British Museum because they're still very sensitive about the Parthenon sculptures and anything that would cause there to be, you know, reignite any controversy or go through a bad media cycle about it as well. So the first thing that we did, it was early on in ICT, is working with Mark and Brian. We made pretty good artistic models of the Parthenon in all of its ages, not as good as what we could do with laser scans, but we had all of those nice models of the Parthenon as a Greek temple, as a church, as a mosque, and as a ruin. And that was kind of a calling card because we had some nice assets. Like already TV shows were starting to ask us if they could borrow it for their documentary about the Parthenon. And that,
were any of those, were any of those used at the end of your movie where you have the pullout from inside the display case, or was that different?
Yes, inside the display case would have been one of those models that Brian and Mark Brownlow had put together. And by the way, this one was also where we switched from using Radiance to using something that was, you know, inspired certainly in part or took some inspiration from Radiance, among other great research systems, which is Arnold, which is Marcus Fajardo's Arnold system. And
that would have been early Arnold.
Very early Arnold, yeah. Because I met Marcus Fajardo at SIGGRAPH 99. He probably talked to me about Fiat Lux, actually. And in later 2000, he was kind of interested in, you know, getting closer to the Hollywood community, working in Los Angeles. And so I actually hired Marcus Fajardo, and he worked in our lab for a year, and he brought Arnold with him. So we got to experiment with Arnold. I helped helping along, encouraging Marcos to implement image-based lighting into Arnold so we could do HDRI lighting, and it was great for doing that. And that allowed us to, you know, get the kind of renderings that we needed. Now, the sculptures were going to be tricky, probably, but I thought, okay, at least they're like smaller. It's not full Acropolis access. And I talked to an archaeologist that I'd met on a trip to Egypt in 1999 named Philippe Martinez. He's actually an Egyptologist, not a classical scholar, but still knows a million times more about the Acropolis than I do. And he pointed out, you know what? There's not only plaster casts of, like, you know, a third of the Parthenon sculptures in my hometown of Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, but there's this museum in Basel, Switzerland that has plaster casts of freaking everything. They have plaster casts of some stuff that has since gone missing. It's technically more complete than what you can find if you go to Athens and London and the little bits in Copenhagen.
So
and
wait
Paris
a second, are you telling me that what is in the film, it was actually from Switzerland, not England?
What's in the film is the geometry that we scanned in Switzerland. And thank you, Basel Sculpture Hall, for letting us invade your museum for 5 days, texture mapped with tourist photos I took in the British Museum.
So in the film where we see in old school, we'd have called the wireframe, but it's like the non-lit final rendered kind of like text. Well, it's the geometry map effectively. That's the raw stuff from Switzerland, and then it gets layered on top.
Yeah. So, well, some of it, we also had Mark and Brian, like we looked at our architectural books about the Parthenon. And there's a quick shot where we actually paint it with the blue background and the brightly colored.
I was going to ask you about that painting, because I was going to say that you do paint it, right? Which I presume it had been back in the day. And I'm thinking there must have been some central authority that was the architectural advisor on all of this. Was that coming out of Switzerland, out of Greece, or out of you just doing your research?
Mostly us doing research. Like, we had a stack of Parthenon books this tall at the Institute, which are still there outside Kathleen Haas's office, I think, as well as a life-size reproduction of the horse head that was on the east pediment of the Parthenon, which, by the way, I bought from the British Museum gift shop. They don't sell that anymore just because it's kind of a bad look for them selling, you know, making money off of selling copies of the Parthenon sculptures, but it was like on clearance. Right. And it wasn't all that much. It was like $400 or something. It's a life-size thing. It's apparently the horse head that the knight in chess is based off of, is modeled off of the little horse head for that. And, you know, I couldn't put it in my luggage because it's like as big as the head of a horse. So it got shipped to me and I shipped it back to the lab, and it arrived while I was out of town. And I had two friends at the time, one of whom had access to my house, and you can guess where I discovered this horse head waiting for me when I got
home. I just hope it wasn't in a pool of blood.
They did not add the blood, but it was left for me, you know,
Godfather
right
style
my pillow under the covers, which unfortunately, and this is the real tragedy of that, is that at the time I had not yet seen The Godfather. And so it was a little bit lost on me quite a bit, but I get that. I totally get it. In fact, the Academy Museum had a great, exhibit on The Godfather recently, and they had the test dummy head that they used.
Yeah, I saw that.
Actually put a real head in there.
Yeah.
So we really tried to study things. You know, there isn't 100% consensus as to what the central sculptures of the East pediment would have looked like, because that one was quite damaged in antiquity. There isn't perfect consensus as to whether the background was blue or red on the Parthenon frieze, but we made as educated guesses, and no one's complained about any of that. The various TV shows, you know, would come and interview us about the project, like assumed I was a Parthenon expert. And though I knew 10 times more than the people making those documentaries, I still knew a millionth as much as Philippe Martinez. But Philippe got us access in 2002, not only to the Basel Sculpture Hall, where Thomas Lachman over there, the museum curator, put up with us in our hand-built video projector camera. Chris Chu actually was working for me at the time, one of the primary authors of HDR Shop. And, you know, he came up with like considerably better structured light scanning than anybody had. Like, we got great scans at the time. And Philippe also got us access to the Louvre, where they have a very nice piece of Parthenon frieze, one of the metopes that went around the outer rim of the Parthenon that's in high relief, and the head of one of the pediment sculptures, which is in full 3D, the head of Iris. And that's only one of two heads that survived from all of the
pediment
sculptures.
Yeah, I noticed that the Louvre was in your end credits. Thank you. So I was wondering about that. But we could keep going on this for hours. I do want to keep moving forward, because I don't want to skip your 10th anniversary coming up. But let me just jump forward. So the year after this, you guys come out with the High Dynamic Range Imaging book, right? So that's, I don't know how the hell you managed to get a textbook written there when you're doing all this.
Well, the lucky part about that, I mean, Eric Reinhard led that effort. There's four co-authors total. And, you know, the part that I really was fully responsible for was the chapter on image-based lighting. And that, sure. Oh my God, that was so hard to do. That was a lot to
squeeze. And Greg Ward, who is another co-author that you've already mentioned.
Yeah. And Wolfgang Heidrich. Yeah, it was a good group. It was a good group.
Okay. And that's had a second edition, but we won't go there for that. So there's that. And then there's the Digital Emily project. I remember interviewing you in Santa Monica over that. And that was amazing. And then there was stuff with Digital Ira and stuff. But there's this bifurcation of the architectural and the human. And of course, in this period that we're talking about, the digital likeness stuff, the digital human stuff was extraordinary, especially subsurface scattering and the work that the light stage facilitated. I'm wondering, of all that work, there's a lot of credit that's been given to you and the team. There are Academy Awards, there's SciTech Awards, there's Emmys, a whole lot of stuff. Where does the president's scan in 2014, President Obama's scan, fit in that kind of human imaging space for you? Was it like a great thing to do, or was it like a high point? I'm just curious. Like, obviously it's an honor, but for you, it was a kind of a recognition of an entire kind of couple of decades of work.
It was an amazing project to get to be a part of for, you know, it was kind of like touch and go whether it was really going to happen or not. Working with the White House, there were like, you know, lots of, you know, things that needed to get signed and contracts and discussions and all of that. But it really came out of, I mean, probably like Avatar was significant for that, because, you know, Joe Letteri and crew used our light stage facial scanning technique to scan a lot of the principal cast for Avatar. And we showed that we could get down to like skin pore level, 10th of a millimeter detail without slopping people up with alginate and then casting them, which kind of deforms your face. You can actually get close to the same level you can get with, you know, the traditional process, but without, you know, needing to touch anybody. So you can get natural facial expressions. You can get great texture maps as well. And
well, hang on. And also, if you're putting stuff on people's faces, you get one expression, I mean, that's it, right? Like, you're not going to get them to do 48 different expressions or
an entire sort of... That would be a lot of facts. And you can't really shapes. Eyes open
yeah, exactly.
or mouth open because you'll get the stuff in there. So
there's a huge amount of... Yeah. But anyway, go on.
So anyway, that, you know, and then when Avatar came out and, you know, they you know, put the light stage scanning the actors in their B-roll and that got seen a lot. That was a huge shot in the arm for a program. And, you know, based on that, that basically got us an opportunity to build a whole new light stage, improve the polarization patterns, put more cameras on it.
But you'd already had a lot of success with, because there were other films, right? Like The Curious Case of Benjamin Button and stuff, yep. which yep. DD used your stuff on. So it was not as if, like Avatar was a high point, absolutely. But you'd had a lot of films between...
from Spider-Man 2.
Yeah.
Avatar was like... Curious Case of Benjamin Button was like the beginnings of turning over from the old scale, old style, one light at a time reflectance field relighting technique to the high resolution polarized gradient scanning technique. And that was pretty much fully Avatar. And then interestingly enough, today, all of the interest has kind of switched back to the one light at a time reflectance field capture, because that's the kind of data with image-based relighting that's like great to put into machine learning algorithms for computational relighting and training algorithms for that kind of stuff. But you know, essentially at some point the Smithsonian had gotten very excited about 3D digitization of their collection. They have like 100 and almost 50 million items in their collection. Maybe 1% of them are actually on display in one of those museums in Washington, D.C. And they thought we should have an initiative to try to scan it all, right? You know, so to protect against degradation, to make it much more available than it currently is, sitting on shelves, you know, deep in basements. And they had started this effort with a couple of key artifacts they had. And one of the artifacts that they had put a 3D model online of on their new website, you know, 3d.si.edu, was the two life masks made of Abraham Lincoln. And it turns out they made a plaster cast with all the stuff slopped on the face and straws stuck up the nose and everything of Abraham Lincoln when he was campaigning for office originally. And then it turns out something on the order of like a month or so before his assassination. You know, one's without the beard, one's with the beard. The ones, those casts are the basis of what we see in the Lincoln Memorial, for example, and a lot of the likenesses of Lincoln. But they had models of those, and they did this big launch of their project, and somehow they thought, you know what, we don't really have a 3D record of any other president other than Lincoln from when he was in office. There is a 1756 life mask of Washington, but he wasn't president yet. And they thought, hey, well, maybe we can start this up again. And you know, pretty soon after that, we got a call. I think because we were an academic institution, so it was much easier for the Smithsonian to work with us than if we'd been like a commercial institution. And because, you know, we credibly had the best highest resolution facial scanning process on the planet at that time.
And in fact, that rig was at, I'm going to say, was it SIDGRAPH last year in Los Angeles? Because I took a nerf of it because I'm that much of a geek.
Which That's is awesome.
Quite a weird.
We've achieved peak a geek at this point. Thank you.
Yes, but it doesn't look like the traditional light stage. It looks. It was your portable light stage, obviously. But it, how complete was that scan? Given that it wasn't the you know sort of classic light stage sphere that we've kind of known and seen in the making ofs.
Yeah, it was. You know, a great project because we had to challenge a lot of assumptions in order to make it happen. So they basically had reached out and asked in early 2014, would you be able to, can your light stage travel, would you be able to come and scan a VIP here in Washington, D.C.? And they didn't say who it was. I guessed kind of who they might be talking about. And I thought, yeah, you know, let's say yes. And, you know, we'll figure it out.
Out later.
And I had... And the reason that I could say yes is that we had a research project in flight at the time, which was to make a kind of portable light stage, which would use a bunch of flashes and a bunch of cameras only taking one photo, but we'd carefully synchronize the flashes. So each camera would get a photo from a different flash or they'd be in banks. We called it the flash mob. And so this rig, this aluminum chassis had like six flash units and 24 Canon rebels on it. And I just presumed, hey, we're doing active research. it's looking promising. That's what we'll take over there. And then, you know, we published the paper and the results were good and we got a paper published, but they weren't quite as good as what we could do with the light stage, with the light stage X system that we have. And I just realized, you know what, this project's for real. This is also for history. This needs to be, you know, not just the best scan that we can do in Washington, D.C. This needs to be the best scan that, we've ever done. And the only way to do that is to basically take every single thing that was great about the light stage facial scanning process with the polarized gradient illumination and get that onto the mobile rig. So when that project was over, the flash mob, we stripped off all of the cameras and lights from that rig and then just basically stole things off of light stage X. Every one of the Canon 1DX cameras, 50 of the lights, I figured out a way to get 50 lights arranged that would just have enough coverage to see the specular reflection angle ear to ear for the face being scanned. We wouldn't be able to do a one light at a time data set, but that wasn't the requirement for this. And I tried to get exactly 50 lights because that was about the amount we could fit on there. And I thought, you know, it would be kind of nice if it mirrored like the 50 stars in the American flag. And it's almost in the same arrangement as the 50 stars for the 50 states in the United States for that. And then on top of that, we had to get it in a crate that could go in a an airplane cargo container. And at first, they had told us that this might happen in the West Wing of the White House, which has gotten notoriously narrow hallways. And so this rig was also designed so that it could open up flat and then kind of like scooch through sideways right through a single doorway. But in the end, they put us in the state dining room just under the portrait of Lincoln by the fireplace there. And we had plenty of room for that.
Presumably with a suitable amount of security checks, scanning and checking of what was the stuff that you were hauling into the White House, right? It's just not...
Yeah, they have a process for that. And, you know, our stuff, I think we all got, you know, security checked out and they figured out we're all fine. They looked at our equipment. That was all fine. And, you know, we discussed with, you know, our White House liaison, who I presume talked to, you know, anyone else, Secret Service-y, that needed to talk about like what the process would be. And it, you know, it fell to me with, you know, as an amazing honor to like basically explain to President Obama what we need to do for the scan and to actually get him, you know, seated and ready for the scanning to occur. And at our lab, even if we were scanning, you know, Tom Cruise or Angelina Jolie, we'd like book an hour at least. Like even we're told they've got a super tight schedule, you know, it's like, well, we need an hour. It's like, here's where, you know, at one point they said, you know, you're gonna have 2 minutes to do this. And in the end, actually, I'm really happy because not only for our light stage scans, but for the Smithsonian group, which had brought an Artec EVA scanner.
I was going to mention that because you were only doing the face, right?
We got the face. And the idea was to create a 3D printed bust and shoulders. So they got this Artec EVA scanner that they were super experts at using. And they got the back of the head and the shoulders and the necktie and all of that. And that very night afterwards, we put that together as one model. But we ended up from Obama entering the room to us clapping because we're all done. It was 6.5 minutes.
Wow. So did you do like just a ton of rehearsals and like, I mean, how long did it take you to actually set up in the room? Like, was it just curious about the logistics of it?
We first brought it over to the Smithsonian offices, which were down the mall a bit. We did a couple test scans there. Then, you know, we rented the truck that would take it over to the White House and we're told like, you got to rent the truck. And by the way, it can't be a U-Haul. We don't want to see U-Hauls pulling up to the North Portico. It's got to be like a pure white truck. Like it's going to like deliver the wedding arrangements or something like that. And, you know, they had some carpet there so we could roll it into the state dining room. It stayed there overnight, and the day it actually got delivered, I had come back to Albuquerque, New Mexico, because I was in Tim Hawkins's wedding party and I really didn't want to disappoint Tim. So I actually dangerously like flew back to Albuquerque for a day that night, flew back, landed at midnight, and the next morning was our setup day. And that's the day that they like interviewed us. So, you know, we're already kind of wearing suits and we're just generally looking, you know, nervous, like, are we going to get this thing done? So we had a day and we left it all ready to scan me. So we had three people who were our stand-ins for testing the system. And I was the stand-in for height because it
I was going to say that it would really matter what height the person was sitting at, right?
Yeah, it matters a lot because the only way we got the scan done in just a few minutes is basically all the cameras had to be framed and focused. We have no time to touch any cameras. And so, you know, we borrowed this chair from the Smithsonian conference room, basically, executive conference room. So it was nice and leather and looked appropriate and it could roll around. And, you know, we got framed on me. We had another person who was the model for skin tone, was Antoine from our institute. And then my grad student, Paul Graham, who was in the Air Force getting his PhD with us, he was too tall to be a stand-in for height because he was like 6'3.5", but he did have like the prominent ears that Obama has as well. And, you know, our ears were on our job. So we had to make sure we could get somebody who had ears that stick out a bit. And we made sure it could scan all three of us. And then when we framed on me, we left it there. And I think we did one last check on framing the next day, which was June 9th, before Obama came in the room, and then hoped it would be correct. And when he finally did sit in the chair, and we had three monitors that showed us the center camera and the two sidemost cameras, the height was absolutely perfect. But the problem is that unsurprisingly, Obama sits up a little straighter than I do. And so I looked at the side screens. President Obama, you know, once he saw the thing on the front, he starts like, okay, this one's for history. Okay, I got to get some pressure. So he's like kind of fixated on that. He has no ideas there are even screens over here. And I can just see his nose is getting cut off. So I said, you know, hey, looks like the framing's great on the height. Looks like you're just a little far forward. So here, we got to make a little adjustment. And as discussed with the White House staff, the procedure for that is I have to grab the back of the chair and literally scoot him backwards an inch or two in the chair. And how nerve-wracking it is to literally be scooting the leader of the free world around on there. And eventually we got him in there. We did two neutral scans or two like presidential, like ready for 3D printing of a serious portrait. And then one of kind of like that nice winning smile that, you know, that any good leader is able to do. And he certainly was able to do that. And then I was asked to just ask him, hey, is there anything else that you'd like us to cover? Anything you want to reshoot? And he said, you know, nope, I think that just about covers it. And he was off to the Smithsonian chair.
So how, like, he's done that, right? How are you immediately able to do a just a data check that everything worked? Or was it like hours later that you could just check files and see it actually worked?
I was really sure that because I could hear the cameras going click. The biggest nerve-wracking moment was whether all the cameras were going to successfully get into mirror pre-lock mode to do the scan. And, you know, Paul Graham, my grad student, was on the laptop. And there's a moment where, you know, he enters the command in Python that ends up telling all the cameras to go into mirror pre-lock and be ready for the scan. And like every so often that wouldn't work. And then we'd have to reboot everything. And then it's like, I was just hoping it wasn't going to be one of those times. And when he entered the command and like everything went clunk satisfyingly, I instantly started to feel a little bit relieved. I think we were, I guess we didn't really know how in frame or in focus. I had seen on the screens that he looked like he was going to be in frame. We were actually so tightly framed. This is why it's still the highest resolution scan we ever got. Is we were so tightly framed on him that there's only one place his head basically could have been to be in frame from those three monitors. And that's the area that we'd focused on. And when we finally did get the images back in the Smithsonian office that night and start to process it, you know, we looked and, you know, every single photo, you know, nicely framed, razor sharp focus. And yeah, at that point, we were pretty sure we were going to get a good scan.
So I've seen the results, obviously, but I've seen the results as in, you know, I've seen it stuff from your website and things. How did you get any feedback, or what feedback did you get that he'd seen the output of what you'd done? And then how has it been used since it's been done, or has it just been stored away for posterity?
Well, the whole you know, plan is proposed to the White House was actually to kind of make a good boost to the kind of the nascent 3D printing industry. Like Obama had even mentioned something about 3D printing in his State of the Union address in 2014. And so they capitalized on it and said, hey, you know what? We're going to show you a great way to show what 3D printing can do, and we're going to 3D print you. And at the White House Maker Faire, which was on June 20th, the Smithsonian actually had by then successfully gotten a life-size 3D print. Back then, 3D printers were not super fast. So for, you know, probably a third of the time between June 9th and June 20th was actually when that print was being made. And they actually brought the print to the White House Maker Faire. I wasn't there for this, but there's some video of President Obama being presented with this, you know, newly fresh 3D printed sculpture of himself. And, you know, he like looks a little skeptical first and looks around, and you can see him crack a smile, and it's like, okay, he likes it. So that's how I know that he got to see it. I did also right after the scan, because we finished so quickly, you know, apparently they'd booked like 15 minutes for him to be there. We finished at 6:30. So I ended up in this sort of unexpected conversation with President Obama that I had done surprisingly little preparation for, because he kind of asked, okay, so tell me a little bit about all the technology here. And, you know, my gosh, you know, I think I actually tried to explain the polarized gradient facial scanning process to the President of the United States. And all I can remember is this very, very intelligent man looking back, thinking, and clearly desperate to try to make any blessed sense out of what this nice scientist is telling him, so he can possibly, you know, say something to contribute to the conversation, which he actually ended up doing. And we found some other stuff to chat about with that. But I think he liked it. The data and those prints, I guess the data is in the National Archives and the 3D prints are in the collection of the National Portrait Gallery.
It's funny, you know, I had a similar experience once. I was at a function with our prime minister, and there was, you know, a bunch of academics, and we're all standing around, and it was just a freak of organization, but there was going to be a speech, and the prime minister's standing there, and everyone's been cleared to be in the room. And I just happened to be, he turned one way, I turned another, and everybody else all just happened to wander off to get drinks. So at one bizarre moment, it's just me standing there with the prime minister. And he kind of goes, oh, so what are you doing? And so I decided to explain digital humans to him. I'm not going to say which prime minister it was. Let's just say I don't think he was quite as intellectual as Obama. And he just looked at me fairly blankly until the end, and he just went, gosh. And then he winked at me. And to this day, I have no idea what the wink was meant to signify, right? He just like looked at me and went, gosh, and then winked. And I was like, I don't know what to do with that, right? I wasn't quite sure whether the prime minister just hit on me or whether he was just like at a loss of something to do, or he just had something in his eye. So I'm glad your experience was a bit more rewarding. So that was all 10 years ago, right? So, wow. And you're saying that is still the most high resolution facial scan that you've done?
I think so, because the 1DX had great resolution. We used this set of 105 millimeter F mount lenses that I found a matched set of, and it framed him so tightly that like every single pixel was contributing to that facial scan. And when we scan at ICT, I guess we have somewhat higher resolution cameras now, but you know, we just kind of frame a little bit looser for safety. But our only way to get him in focus without touching the focus was to have it framed so tight. And so just the pixels across the face was just higher than anything that we've done since then.
I know when I was being scanned in 2017, I'm going to say it's 2017, we were doing spectral scanning with different spectral ranges on the, and you were doing the close-ups, which was to say not the whole face, but the very, it's quite intrusive, but
yeah, the microgeometry, right?
The microgeometry one. But you weren't doing a spectral, like the actual LEDs on Obama would have been pre-spectral. So, yeah. Okay. So it's high resolution, but not the same.
Yeah. So the lights that were on the Obama scanner came, they were technically like LSX2 lights. And it was like from the first iteration of the light stage that's in ICT. All those lights have been replaced and upgraded since then.
Yep.
But they did have RGB color, but just kind of dim ones on the corners that were indicator lights. And so you could do some image-based lighting with those, but it was mostly the white LEDs, and they had the polarization control. So we just got the spectral definition that the regular RGB of the camera gets for that. You know, we had a color chart in there so that things got put into, you know, sRGB space with, you know, like a daylight illuminant kind of idea. But we hadn't gotten into dissecting the details of skin reflectance quite that much yet.
So we've been reminiscing over 10 years, 25 years, 20 years, et cetera. But in this discussion we've had today, which I've been enjoying immensely, we have done this kind of vacillation between this architectural thing and this human thing that obviously they're related, but to a certain extent they're different. Is it time now for you to swing back to architecture, or like where, without going into, you know, like a huge amount of depth, but like just without prying, I guess, what's on the horizon for your interest? In other words, are you interested in going to environment stuff, or are you wanting to looking?
Yeah, environments are still very much part of you know, what we look at, and you know, what we want to have technology that has the ability to, you know, to capture, to reproduce. The field of you know, computer vision and computer graphics has offered us all of these exciting new techniques with NeRFs and Gaussian splats and, you know, whatever's soon on the horizon. I would be very surprised if within the next 6 months we don't have some mashup between the two, or something that, you know, combines the advantages of both, which will be earth shaking. But basically, you know, I work for, you know, the Netflix family, and, you know, we want to help filmmakers create their shows. And some stuff shot for real, some stuff is virtual. It will continue to be that way. And you can basically, you know, go to your Netflix account, press any show after a random amount of time, press pause, and it's probably a person in an environment. And that's why we work on people, and that's why we work on environments. And that's how we tell stories.
It's the establishing shot and then cut in for the close-up, right? And you want both of those to aid in the storytelling.
Yeah, that's the idea.
Well, Paul, it's been terrific talking to you today. Congratulations on these three anniversaries we've touched on today, and of course, all the other stuff. We've got, we had the joy of having you at FX Guide many times, so we're going to put links to some of the previous stories in the show notes so people can refer to that. And yeah, great seeing you again, my friend, and thank you so much for taking time to talk to us.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure, and thanks for everything you do for the visual effects community. It makes such a difference. Thanks so much.
It was really great to hear some of those insights into what went into making the films that Paul has done. So, Paul, I appreciate you taking time to do that. I look forward to seeing Paul, as well as many of you, at SeaGraph in the United States this summer. It's being held at the end of July in Denver, Colorado, and I'll definitely be there. Well, that's it for this episode of the FX Podcast. For Mike Seymour, I'm John Montgomery. Thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.